Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. It's a great, great show today. We feature two equally talented but very, very different filmmakers, both directors. First off, you'll hear from horror maestro Darren Lynn Bousman on his new film, Saint Agatha. And then documentary filmmaker François Margolin on his new film, Jihadists. That's all coming up on Endeavors. Well, it's the beginning of a new month, and that means back to two shows a week, hopefully. As longtime listeners of this show know, the two types of films that I really enjoy, I enjoy all films, but the two that I do a lot of interviews about are horror and documentaries. And we have both of those featured on the show today. My first guest is a director who has made a name for himself in the horror genre. He first got noticed with his film Saw 2, which was actually a repurposing of an original screenplay that he wrote, and then it got incorporated into the Saw franchise. That film was quite well received that he got asked to return for Saw 3 as well as Saw 4. He then left the Saw franchise for something a little bit lighter, one could say, when he did the great film Repo: The Genetic Opera. His other films include Mother's Day and 11-11-11, as well as the upcoming Death of Me, featuring Liam Hemsworth and Maggie Q. But he has a new film coming out to theaters next week, February 8th, called Saint Agatha. It takes place in the 1950s, mostly at a convent. He is Darren Lynn Bousman, and he spoke to me the other day about Saint Agatha and about his work in the horror genre. Here is our conversation. Darren Lynn Bousman, hello, welcome, thanks for being here today.
Of course, thanks for having me.
So you have a new film out, Saint Agatha. It's another great horror film that you always make good work. How did this project come to you? Was it the normal, they sent you the script and you were interested, or was there another way?
Actually, I was in the middle of another production, something called The Tension Experience. And The Tension Experience was an immersive theater production, very much like the game meets Westworld. And it was a real world, real life. You have to basically interact with actors, and your choices dictate what happens to you. And in this, Sabrina Kern, who plays St. Agatha, was the lead of this production. And one afternoon I got home, and there was a book inside my bag that I didn't put there. And come to find out, the line producer snuck it into my bag and hoped I would read it. Well, I had nothing going on that night, so I actually read the script. And the next day I came in, and he was like, "Did you get the thing I left in your bag?" And I jokingly said, "I'll only do it if I can bring the entire cast of The Tension Experience with me." And I was only half joking, and they ended up hiring me for the movie and letting me bring Sabrina Kern, as well as a few other actors. Trin, who plays Paula, the girl who's strangled with the umbilical cord. Miles, who's the doctor. Bobby King, who's the grifter, who they like play the con on with the card thing. And a few others. The writer, Clint Sears. So they allowed me to kind of bring on my team. And so it was such a quick turnaround from when they gave me the script to when I would actually be shooting. I said yes, because a lot of times when you're in Hollywood, movies could take years. You read a script, and literally it could take years before you actually get to the point of actually filming it. So I said yes, and months later, Sabrina and I were there making the movie.
You mentioned that the length of time it can make it take. Sometimes I find that horror films tend to happen and tend to develop quicker than maybe other types of films in Hollywood. Do you find that that's just due to budgetary issues that a lot of these types of films tend to happen at a bit of a quicker pace?
Yes and no. So I mean, there have been horror movies that I have that take years and years and years and years to get made. The problem is with Hollywood, a lot of times people tell you they have something financed and they absolutely do not have it financed. This was one of those things where they said, hey, the movie's fully financed, we're ready to do it immediately. They actually were. They actually were fully financed, and they actually were able to do it immediately. I mean, I think that with horror, why horror goes quicker is a lot of times the budgets on horror films are a lot less intense than some other movies. So, like for example, with this movie, this is a very, very, very low budget movie. So, I think that obviously helped to make it a quick turnaround.
And yet, it strikes me that some of the best films we see out there are ones that have lower budgets. Do you think having less money can enhance the creativity of a project?
Yes. Well, I mean, here's what I think it is. When you have less money, you're allowed to take more risks and do more things. Meaning, like, if you look at a movie like The Witch, I don't know if you saw The Witch, that was out a few years ago, or It Follows. These are movies that weren't, you know, they didn't have $100 million on the line. They had a couple million dollars on the line. And so when you do something like that, usually they give people more of a leeway to do weird things. Like, for example, this movie is a perfect example. Due to the budget, I was able to bring Sabrina Kern with me. Sabrina has never acted before. I mean, never been in a movie before. This is her first film. And on top of that, she's not even a native English speaker. She's from Switzerland. She's Swiss-German. So the risk that they allowed me to bring who I wanted to onto this would never happen if I had $50 million or $100 million to make the movie.
You mentioned Sabrina and a couple other the cast members that you brought. One thing that struck me about this film was the majority of the leads are female. Was that something that also intrigued you, especially in this era, you know, of Me Too and the recent 4% pledge that was taken?
Well, it did. I mean, we made the movie 2 years ago. But I will tell you that I've always found females more interesting to watch. And I think that if you go back and look at my earlier work, from the Saw franchise to Repo to Mother's Day, they were all leads. The females were all leads. From Bahar to Shawnee Smith to Alexa Vega to Rebecca De Mornay, they've all been female leads. I did a TV series where I executive produced, set in an all-girls school in Japan. I just find it more interesting. I jumped at the chance to do this. And I love pitting two strong females against each other. And again, it's something you'll notice if you go back and look at my films. Mother's Day, it was Jamie King versus Rebecca De Mornay. And this, it's Sabrina Kern versus Carolyn Hennessy. I think there's just something cool about that. You know, listen, I love action films and The Rock and all these as much as the next guy. But there's something just inherently badass about watching two strong females shoot the scenery and go after each other.
Most, you know, people will know you mostly from your work in the horror genre. Of course, you mentioned Saw and Repo. What do you like specifically about the art of the horror film?
Well, I think that horror has the ability to get under your skin like no other genre can. You know, I feel like a broken record because I say this a lot, but I think it's so true that horror has a way to imprint itself on you and stay in your memory where other genres don't. So when I was growing up as a kid, I loved going to the movies. I went to the movies all the time. I don't remember where I was the first time I watched Short Circuit or Caddyshack 2 or Weekend at Bernie's, but I do know where I was when I saw Nightmare on Elm Street or Friday the 13th or Hellraiser, because those movies left an impression on me. And I think to me, that's why I love horror, is that, you know, you might not remember things about St. Agatha, but you'll remember a girl was strangled with an umbilical cord. When those moments happen, those shocking things, they stay with you. And so I've always found that for me as a person, horror has kind of, I don't know, some of my memories, my earliest memories come to being frightened or being scared. And I think that to me, that's just something that I love to push out there as well, is to create images and things in people's head that they will remember long past the credits roll.
It's interesting you mention that, because watching this film, it's one of the few times where I've actually been squeamish. I don't get squeamish that easily, and there was one scene where I sort of had to recoil in horror, so to speak. As a director, where do you find that line between sort of, you know, entertaining and telling a good story, and then having that shock value of what happens on camera?
Well, this is a much more reserved film than some of my others. You know, Saw was much more in your face and exploitative. Repo was much more in your face and flamboyant. I think this took a more reserved approach. Yes, there's violence in it. Yes, there's torture and sadistic things. But it's done in a much more subtle way, and it's more about characters. Now, I'll give you one example, and a spoiler for those listening to this. Close your ears for the next 15 seconds because you don't want to hear this. But there's a scene where the girl, Courtney Haverlson, throws up, and she is forced to eat her puke by Mother Superior. The old me would have shown the puke on the plate, would have done close-ups as the spoon hit it, would have done, you know, close-ups of the mouth as it tried to digest it. But in this, I much rather played it on the reaction of everyone watching it. And so I think that for me, it's got to service the story. And I think that I've kind of matured a little bit as a filmmaker in knowing what's important to show the audience and what to leave to their imagination.
You know, I've talked a lot with the different horror directors over the years about how we're seeing a resurgence of the intelligent horror film. We're not just seeing slasher and blood and guts, but we're seeing much more intelligent stories. Does that go back to what you said about how you can take more risks because it's a lot more low budget and consequently the stories and the style becomes a lot more smarter?
It is. I mean, and again, like I said, when you're dealing with a bigger budget movie, I don't want to say dumbing it down, that's not the right word, but you're dealing with middle America. You're dealing with what are the masses going to enjoy and love. And I think when you're dealing with a smaller budget, it's more about what's edgy and cool, what you like, what you think is what you think is interesting, as opposed to what the masses think is interesting. And so what happens is you get some real art out of that. You get some real intense, beautiful, haunting, horrific things out of that. Where again, if it was much more in the line, it would probably be more directing by committee, which lower budget films give you the ability to do it more just kind of on your own.
You mentioned For the Masses, and I think all horror, you know, more so than any other genre, except for maybe sci-fi, has a very, very tight-knit fan base. What do you like about just being a part of the horror community?
It's funny, I was just interviewed for a documentary, and I saw the first cut of it, called The Horror Crowd, which answers this whole kind of question. You know, it's, we get to live in nightmares, and that sounds horrible, but it's not. It's great. Like, we get to create these worlds of ghosts and goblins and things that go bump in the night. I mean, Halloween is my favorite season, and I look forward to it all year. It's every day it's Halloween here. It really is. And, you know, it's what a lot of people don't realize is how close everyone in the horror crowd is. From, you know, Eli Roth, to James Wan, to Rob Zombie, to Guillermo del Toro, we all know each other. And we talk to each other, and we help each other, and we call each other. And an example, I was just in Thailand shooting the movie, and I was stuck on something, and I emailed Guillermo del Toro, and I was like, hey, this is crazy, but you have a minute to talk. 5 minutes later, my phone rings, and it's Guillermo. Now, he had just won the Academy Award for Shape of Water, and he takes time out of his day to call me. I was battling with the MPAA on something, and I couldn't get an R rating, and I didn't want to sacrifice anymore. And I reached out to Rob Zombie, and I said, hey, can you help me with something? I'm completely confused on what to do. And Rob walked me through the process. And that is an amazing feeling, because it's like everyone is so helpful. And, you know, some of the nicest people I've met come out of the horror world. You would think we would be scary and sadistic and worshiping Satan, and that's not at all what it is.
Speaking of worship, this is a good segue. Of course, Saint Agatha takes place at a convent in the 50s, and there's always been a lot of religious allegory in film, but particularly a lot in horror films. Why do you think religion makes a good base a lot of the time for some of the themes that are talked about in these types of films?
Well, I think for me, a couple of things. I hope I don't offend everyone in the world by this, but you know, religion, a lot of what you hear in religion could come across as fairy tales if they were presented in any other method. A man who lives in the cloud, but if you pray to him, he grants wishes. A man parts the sea and lived inside a whale. A serpent talked. A bush. I mean, like, you know, there's so many different crazy stories that come out of religion. Yet, as a society, as a civilization, as a world, we believe in it because we need to believe in something. And so I think that when you begin to question religion, when you begin to question the reasons behind things and the motivations, it's fascinating because, you know, looking out my window right now, there's four churches on this street. It is something that is so important and ingrained in our lives. But if you read the Bible, if you go back through history, wars fought over the Bible, torture because of the Bible, killings within the Bible. I think it's ripe with story. And again, nothing is more passionate than when you talk to someone about religion. Talk to three different people about their beliefs in religion, and it brings up such, you know, love, hate, animosity, joy. It ranges all the emotions. And I think that it's scary because it's the unknown. It is absolutely unknown. No one single person can claim they have the complete answer to it. And I think that's what makes religion fascinating. That's why I'm fascinated by religion.
In a film, pacing is often everything, and it is key to a story. And I noticed that in your film, it does move quite quickly. How conscious was that? Was that something that was set up when you were shooting, or did that pacing come more in the post production and editing process?
Editing, absolutely. Shooting is slow and monotonous, and you never know what you have until you get in the edit room. And then when you get in the edit room, you look at it, and you're like, okay, that doesn't work, or I'm bored here, or the audience is going to be bored here. So then we begin to introduce the idea of rapid cutting and montages and all of that. So I would say it's absolutely through the editing process.
Horror films often can be about effects, not necessarily so much this one, but how do you go about setting early on in your process, setting the tone for the specific type of movie you want to make?
You just got to ask what you want the audience to feel. What is the feeling you want them to have in the audience? So something like Repo, I wanted them to just be smiling and tapping their toes and making it really culty and campy. With something like Mother's Day, I want to get under your skin. I want it to be disturbing, and I want you to feel bad and like a voyeuristic, like you shouldn't be watching what you're seeing. I think every movie has that thing that you want the audience to feel. And so you just got to look at what that is you want the audience to feel and then ask yourself, how do I shape a scene around that feeling? And that's how I kind of approach all of my films.
Horror films are notorious for having, you know, B-list, C-list, up-and-coming actors and actresses. But you do have one person that's sort of a name in this production, Carolyn Hennessy. What was it like working with somebody of that caliber?
Carolyn she's amazing. And I think that I was kind of joking with her yesterday. I said that when I sat down with Tobin Dell for the first time to talk about the script for Saw 2, he terrified me. He literally scared me. Tobin is such an intense, haunting, horrific just presence, the way he looks at you. I felt the same way when I cast Carolyn. Carolyn is the sweetest woman in the entire world, but you sit down next to her, and she's a scary person. Like, she terrified me. Now, she has become one of my closest, dearest friends after this production, someone that I'll be working with again and again and again, but she just got it, and sometimes actors just don't get it. She just got it. I mean, from minute one, she knew who Mother Superior was, she knew the character, and she knew how to play it, and I was very lucky to have a chance to work with her.
You also had something that maybe some directors consider a challenge, but you directed one of the writers in the film, Sean Fletcher, who I know plays the deputy. As a director, how do you go about directing an actor who is also responsible for the words that you are directing?
It's hard, honestly, it really is. Because specifically in the case of Sean and Sarah and Andy, who are the three original writers of the script, they sat with the script for years, literally years, and developed it and wrote it and tried to, you know, make it their own. And then here someone like me comes in that has a completely, you know, unique vision to maybe not what they were thinking. So they envision a scene a particular way, then I come in and I'm like, no, I want to do it like this. it's always awkward because you want to respect the material, you want to respect what they were going for. But at the same time, like, you've hired me for a reason. So Sean was great. Like, he was completely great and it was game for everything. But there is that weird, you know, there's that weird thing that you don't want to upset the guy who spent years of his life doing this.
You also, of course, mentioned Sabrina, and not only is she not a native English speaker, but this was her first film. Were there any challenges you found in directing a first-time actor or someone who's making their maiden film appearance in your project?
No. Since Sabrina and I had just worked together on The Tension Experience, which is the most arduous, dense, insane process ever, this was very easy for us. We're very good friends, very, very good friends. So I think for her, she obviously it's an overwhelming thing for her because it's her first movie. She's up against Carolyn Hennessy, and we literally put her through the works. I mean, torture, you know, put her in coffins, make her drink puke, get pregnant, have a child. She went through the ringer. And I bet she did it like a champ. I think she was fantastic in it. But no, she's one of the most prepared actors I've ever worked with. She has a photographic memory, and I've heard about it, never knew what it really was. But it was, you would hand her a piece of paper, she would glance down at it for 30 seconds, and then she'd have every single line, comma, beat, memorized in seconds. I think I was very lucky to be able to bring her on as production. I think she did great in it.
Well, you alluded to earlier some of the scenes, the torture scene, the one where Catherine has to eat her puke. I think for me, the most challenging scene I had to watch was when Mary was being buried alive and then she had the food spat on her. I'm curious as to, for you, what the most difficult scene to film was.
Well, that one was one of them, and it had to do with the fact of the coffin. That, you know, we shot, due to the aspect ratio we shot in, the coffin itself, it never really felt claustrophobic because we couldn't fill the frame with the coffin. You couldn't just be in the coffin. And how, you know, there was challenges to that because how do you show the coffin is closed and make it feel claustrophobic? And then we had to build, like, false walls. And then it was a very, very, very challenging thing. It was intense. That scene was definitely intense. Specifically, the movie was so low budget. We only had a few locations. Constantly making the film feel engaging and feel, you know, tense in such a limited amount of locations. That was always hard. But again, I've worked with the cinematographer, Joe White, who did Repo and did The Barons and 11/11 and Mother's Day with me. So I was lucky to have a great cinematographer on my side to help facilitate that.
We mentioned working with stars, and I know in your next movie that I'm reading about, Death of Me, you get to work with both Luke Hemsworth and Maggie Q. Are you able to tell us anything about that project right now?
Yeah, it's a great film. I'm really excited. We just finished it. Got to shoot it in Thailand, which was an insane experience in itself. It's the story of an American couple who go to Thailand for a vacation, and then they wake up with an unexplained video on their phone of the husband, which would be Luke Hemsworth, strangling and killing Maggie Q, but they're both very much alive. So the rest of the movie is them trying to figure out what the video was, why it happened, and how they're still walking around this island. It's a nasty little thriller, but it's very cool. I was really, really happy with it. We're in the middle of editing it right now.
You mentioned that you got it to shoot in Thailand. For you as a filmmaker and a visual storyteller, what's the most exciting part about getting to shoot overseas, Europe, any foreign country?
I'm sorry, you broke up there. Say that one more time.
Oh, sorry, I was just saying, you just shot the last film in Thailand. For you as a filmmaker and a visual storyteller, what's the most exciting part about getting to shoot in a foreign nation?
Well, I mean, I've been very lucky. I was able to shoot a movie in Barcelona, a movie in Tokyo and Japan, you know, obviously Canada, and now Thailand. It's crazy because they make films differently. Every place makes films differently. And so what I feel like, to me, I'm getting a crash course in, you know, it's continually getting to go back to film school and learn new tricks to be able to add to my repertoire. I mean, obviously, you get to see the world, and I get to take my kid with me, and my kid got to go walk around these amazing temples in Japan. And my wife and I get to travel to places we never in a million years be able to afford. But I think it also helps get you out. Like, for me, I work best when I'm outside of my comfort zone. And so being outside of my house and outside of my office, it just creates a whole other dynamic, a whole other world. So I hope I get to keep leaving the country and doing things like this.
As a director, you've worked with a lot of the same actors over and over again in multiple films, like Jay LaRose, Athena Kakarakis, Marty Adams. Does that go back to what you were saying earlier about how close the horror film community is, and that you always just find yourself participating in each other's projects? Or is there something else that made you cultivate these specific relationships?
Well, no, I just like working with people I like working with. So, you know, I've worked with Alexa Vega a bunch because Alexa Vega and I get along, and she's a great actor. You know, I've had Joe White shoot my last 7 movies or whatever because I like Joe White and I like working with him. But I just, life's too short, and movies are already too stressful, that I just want to work with people that I get along with. And it's fun because I always introduce new people into that stable, and you know, Carolyn Hennessy will now be part of that stable of actors I always go back to. It's just, when you find something that works and you find someone that you like working with, just continue to work with them.
Now, I know originally you had a movie called The Desperate, which was sort of turned into Saw 2, but so is that project over, or have you ever thought about reworking what your original script was and trying to make that film again?
I would love to try to make it. I've actually joked around with the producer, Mark Berg, about giving me the rights back to it. It's a lot more complicated than that. Because it was based on Saw 2, or Saw 2 is based on that, there's something, it's a rights issue. It's called an underlying rights, or it's the chain of title. So it would be a legal nightmare for me to try to get it back, but it's not impossible. It's such an interesting story, and the movie is vastly different. The Desperate script was so different than Saw 2. I think I just got to keep begging Lionsgate and Mark to give it back to me.
But speaking of that, how as a filmmaker, what do you think the Saw franchise did for you professionally?
Gave me a platform. I mean, I was 26 years old or 25 years old. I'd never directed a thing in my life. And I was able now to parlay that into 14 other films. So, you know, if I started off in some small indie, I would not have been able to continue to make the movies that I have been for the length that I've been able to make them. So it gave me a career.
Have you, obviously you've made your entire career here in the horror genre, but do you have thoughts about, you know, directing either a comedy or just like a straight drama?
Yeah, I mean, I would like that. I think whatever I do, whatever that is that I do, is going to end up being disturbing. It's going to be, you know, something that's got something that's kind of macabre about it. But yeah, I mean, I would love to do an action or a thriller or something like that that's a little sidestep from horror. And I think that The Death of Me is more in that line. It's very much definitely not horror, I would say. The Death of Me is much more of a thriller than it is a horror film. So maybe that will be the first into doing that. But yeah, I would love to explore other genres.
Well, the film is Saint Agatha. It's a great film. It's not always easy to watch in parts, but I think that's what makes it so appealing. Darren Lynn Belsman, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, man.
Alrighty. Have a good one. Cheers.
That was my conversation with film director Darren Lynn Bousman. His new film, Saint Agatha, starring Sabrina Kern and Carolyn Hennessy, hits theaters on February 8th. From horror, we move to documentary. Although it could be argued that this documentary is about real life horror. François Margolin and his co-director spend a considerable amount of time following around Muslim extremists and Islamic terrorists. The result is Jihadists, a very interesting look at the people who create
so much quote-unquote evil in the world. And this film was very personal for François, as he had relatives who were killed in the Holocaust. It was banned in his home country of France because it was accused of being sympathetic to terrorist ideals. Margeline says obviously that is not the case, and it was a very bizarre situation that followed. I saw the trailer, and I highly recommend it. It's about people, even though we may disagree with the person or people who are being portrayed in the film. The film is Jihadists. It's a documentary that's out now. I recently spoke to François, who was in Los Angeles for the American debut of the film. He is not just a documentarian. He's also been involved as a writer and producer, both in fictional and nonfiction programming, including The Art Dealer and Flight of the Red Balloon with Juliette Binoche. This is my conversation with director François Margeline. François Margeline, hello, bonjour, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Yes, thank you.
Nice to see you. You have a film out, Jihadists, a documentary, and I'm very, very intrigued. I know you stated in the trailer that this was a very personal film for you, given your family's connection to the Holocaust. But what made you decide that you wanted to follow around Islamic jihadists the way you did?
But the idea was to show these people, to show what they have in the head, what they are thinking, and to see, to show that they are not fool or crazy people. I met these people a long time ago because I was in Afghanistan at the time of the Taliban in 2000, 1 year before September 11. And I meet these people. I know that they think very logical things. I regret to say that. They're not fools. Logical things about the society, about the future, about the humanity. And they are not only individuals who choose something. It's like a tendency in the Islam. It's a minority in the Islam. It's very clear for me. But it's a tendency inside who, since long time, has ideology about life, about the future, about the paradise, about everything.
When you're making a film that is inherently this political and deals with a subject that most people are going to disagree with, how do you balance that fine line between wanting to tell the story you want to tell and not having the film become a platform for these viewpoints?
My idea is absolutely the contrary of a propaganda movie. It's to show what these people who decide to be our enemies are thinking. I think it's better to know the enemy to fight against him. And I think I go exactly in the sense of all the people. Maybe sometimes it's difficult to hear the thinking of enemy, but it's a way to know the thing, to know the reality. To be blind is a very bad thing. And since I'm young, I'm thinking that because my family was killed apart in the Shoah by bullets in Ukraine and Lithuania. So I for me, to be blind is the worst thing and is absolutely not a tribune for the expression of these people. It's exactly the contrary. But to hear these people, it's important for me.
And it's funny because I know that when it was initially released, this film was banned in your home country because it was released following Charlie Hebdo, and it was people thought it was you were empathetic. Talk about that experience. What exactly happened? How did it? Why was it banned the way it was?
It's a very strange story because really the film was co-produced by the two most important TV channels in France, Canal Plus and France Télévisions. And when we finished the movie, it was just at the time of the events of Charlie Hebdo and Hyper Cachet and it was at the time of Bataclan, exactly. And at the time, we were invited everywhere on the TV to when we show some trailer of the movie. Because everybody was for the film, was very interested because nobody understood at this time why it was this terror attack and why it was so much people they were killed by terrorists. So and I don't know why exactly at this moment the government 1 month after decide to ban the film, to censor it and to oblige us to be outside of the movie theater. At the end, it was forbidden to the people under 18, like a porno movie. It was crazy, and it was no documentary, a political documentary banned like that since 50 years in France, since the Algerian War. And at this time, we show the movie in France. It was a very interesting debate with the people. All the people, they wanted to see the movie. But with the government, it was a big problem because they don't wanted that the film was shown on the TV, released on the TV, because it was not the strategy of the government. It was very interesting for the people, but not the strategy of the government, because the government want to explain all the time that the people that are making terror attack are not... There are only crazy people coming from the psychiatric hospital, and it's not true. At the end, in Bataclan, we know now that it was organized from Raqqa and Mosul in Syria and Iraq, that it was like almost 25 people, they organized the things. For the terror attack also in Nice, in 2016, it was at the beginning. The Ministry of Interior in France say the guy has sexual problem. In reality, it was organized also from Raqqa. It was like also 10 or 15 people involved in this story. So it was not the strategy of the government. Maybe it will be changing in the future, but for the moment, it's always the same idea to say. They are loup solitaire, lonely wolf, as we say in France, or psychiatric guy who are making terror attack. And it's not true. I know these people. I know what they're in the head. I know that these people are very related together. They are working together, and they are more and more efficient, and more and more people are in. Are involved in the Salafism and in the jihadism, and it's a reason it was maybe this politic of the government. I hope in the future it will be changed, but I'm not sure for the moment. But what I know about censorship, it's always finishing.
You're in Los Angeles right now. How do you find the film has been received outside of France and outside of Europe?
Very well. What is very strange, the film was shown on two TVs before United States. It was shown in Tunisia in prime time at the Tunisian TV with a debate. I was there with some imams, some military. it was very interesting for the people to discuss about Islam, about what's happened in the Islam now. It was also shown in Kurdistan TV. Kurdistan is in Iraq. Kurdish people are Muslim, but very tolerant with the others. So it was very interesting for all these people. And in the United States, I have a lot of debate in New York last week. Yesterday it was like a premiere in Los Angeles. It was no problem with what's inside the movie. We are debating about what these people are saying. And in France, it was very different because it was about the censorship of the movie. So it's much more interesting, and it's the reason I did this movie with my friend Lemin Oulsalem, is to have a debate with the people about what is Islam now, why there is terror attack, why these people are thinking like that. And it's very interesting because in United States, I think the people understand very well the things.
I want to bring up something you mentioned, because there's been a lot of debate in our culture the last couple of years, especially I think since Trump took power, about the lines of freedom of speech and freedom of religion, and I think your film covers both those areas quite well. What have you noticed about that debate, both in your home country and when you come to the United States?
This debate is very interesting because the terrorists, the jihadists, they are killing more Muslims than other people than people of other religion. They kill also Jews in France, or journalists, or French people who have no religion, or they are Catholic, I don't know. The debate is very interesting, but it's important for the Muslim, for the future, to know what is, and to say what is the difference between them and between their religion and these people, because it's a problem since the beginning of Islam, since Mahomet. It was this type of debate. Mahomet himself had the two way of thinking when you read the history of this period, and it's very important to know that is not Islam, but that is important to say, and it's very important for Muslim to say that, because it's important for the future of Islam, for the tolerance of, and for, and also maybe for Muslim to say very clearly that these people are not like them, and that Muslim can be also a religion of tolerance. It's very important, I think, for the future of all the country, especially in France, because in France we are maybe one of the worst, I don't know, this is a good name for that, worst country for that, because it was it was a lot of emigration since 60 years in France, and now all these people we are coming from Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. They are now French, and they are coming from Arabic country. And I think Salafism is more important in the Arabic world. Is not so important in the Muslim world, but in the Arabic world, it's very important. So it's important, especially in France or maybe in Belgium, to make the difference between these two tendencies, and to see clearly that Islam can be very different from these people.
I know that in France, over the last, you know, 5 or so years, there have been a lot of laws to make the country more and more secular. Like, you can't wear certain religious headwear in public. And you know, and then you had Charlie Hebdo and Bataclan. Do you think the laws that the previous French government passed have made things not worse, but perhaps more vulnerable to these types of attacks?
No, but I think what they say don't solve the problem. I have no solution to solve the problem, but I think we are not on the good way, because it's important, I think, to say clearly the things, and not to tolerate something what happened in the suburbs of Paris, of Toulouse, of Marseille, I don't know, in France, because it's very it was like a trauma in France with all of this attack, as you say. But it's important to solve the problem, to say the things, not to be blind. I think when you're blind, you're all the time missing something. You never solve the solution. I can be very clear. If I was born at the time of the Nazis, for example, and I don't compare exactly because it's not the same thing, but I will be very happy to make interview for Hitler or Himmler, because I think that it will be very important for the people, especially maybe for Jews, to know what these people had in the head, and maybe they will be more afraid of what happened a few years after. I think it's always important to tell the truth, to know what the people are thinking. It's the most important thing, and it's the reason I'm documentarist, I'm making movies. For me, is the reason of my life.
After having followed the jihadists around, the gentlemen around for a while, do you have an idea of what makes people evil, or what makes people do the actions that they do, or do you think that's the wrong frame of reference that we should be looking at?
I don't know how the people have even in the head. It can be it arrived in the past also in other situations and also in other religion. It was same type of thing with conquistadors for South America. But it was 5 or 6 centuries ago. I think it's maybe the reason of that it's because there are no more ideology for young people to trust. I think communism or socialism disappear, not exactly, but on the way to disappear. Arab nationalism disappear also. So some people, they turn to the religion, to the hardest thing in the religion. For example, the videos of ISIS were they like very much the people in the suburbs of Paris or in London, or I don't know where, because it was like a horror movie. They like, especially young people, they love horror movies, and they like this video. It's terrible to say, but it's like that. I think the human being is complicated, and sometimes can have the human being is not good all the time. It can be very bad also. We know that from the history, and I think it's exactly this type of thing. And especially, I think the religion can be very dangerous because it's not something rational. I think since 2 centuries in Europe, I don't know exactly in Canada or in United States, all the things are coming from the logical, from rationalism, from everything has an explanation. But I think in the human spirit, there is not all the time explanation.
I want to pick up on that because I read a study recently that said that the youngest two generations, so sort of the tail end of, you know, Gen X, the millennials, and this current generation, are far less religious and less likely to be religious than previous generations. And so if that trend continues and we see less religion in people's lives, do you think then that there will be less terrorism going forward in the future?
No, it's not a question of religion, because I think if the people they want to be religious, is maybe the period, is the history of our societies now. No, it's not that. It's to say clearly there is difference between religion and on terrorism and also that tolerance is very important for the humanity, even if you didn't agree with somebody else, with another religion. You have not to kill them and to try to convert them. And some people are sure of that. They are thinking, is that the lesson of Islam? And it's not true. So I think it's not less religion we will save the humanity. For me, it's not this question.
What do you think people, and specifically, I guess, Western culture and Western media, what do they get wrong most about Islam?
I don't know exactly, because I think it's a little different, I suppose, in North America and in France. It's not to tell clearly the things. It's not because when you don't say, for example, I tell you about France. There is a confusion in France and in Europe between migrants and terrorists. And it's very dangerous because when you don't explain the difference, you have to be clear, very clear, because some of the terrorists were with the migrants, inside the migrants. They are not migrants, but they were inside when they came in France to organize the Bataclan attack, for example. And it's clear. It's important not to let the extreme right say this type of thing. It's important to tell the truth, to make the difference for the people, because if you don't tell the truth, the majority of the people, they are thinking all the governments, all the media, they are not telling the truth, they don't want to say the reality of the thing, and in reality, all the Muslims are terrorists. It's not true. You have to tell the reality of the things and to tell that there is the difference, but that some people inside the migrants can be terrorists. But it's very, very different, and it's very important if you want to save, Europe, because in some countries, especially in the East European countries, now the people are sure that there is a confusion between the two, and it's very dangerous for the future and the return of the extreme right and the populism. It's maybe one of the causes that.
What do you want people and audiences to take away from the film or learn from the film when they see it?
It's to know, to be convinced it's not a psychiatric problem, that it will be not solved with pills, with electroshock. I don't know the word in English. Electroshock is in French, like it's something what you do in a psychiatric hospital.
Yeah, same in English, electroshock, yeah.
Like it was in the Soviet Union at the time, in the 60s or 70s, at the time of dissident people. You will not solve that with this type of thing. You have to discuss, you have to tell the truth, you have to show the reality, you have to propose to the people different things, and especially for young people. And it's not only a question of economy, it's not only a question of money. It's a question, it can be also. But it's a question of promise for the future, to give a future to the people. It's only way to solve the problem. I'm not sure it's possible to solve the problem, because it's very, very important now in the Muslim world, or especially in the Arabic world, or maybe in France too. So I'm not sure it will disappear. But the people have to think with the film that it's a very important problem, and it's not because there is less terror attacks these days, because Islamic states disappear and the people are a little lost. But I'm sure in few months, in few years, it will be terrorists will be back, and it's not what I hope, but it's unfortunately the reality of our future. So I want that the people change their mind and to understand what's happened in the world and not to be blind, as I tell you before.
Well, the film is Jihadists, and it's out in North American theaters now. François Margolin, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yes, thank you very much for this interview. I'm very happy to talk to you.
Enjoy Los Angeles.
Excuse me for my Franglish.
That was my conversation with François Margolin. He is the director of Jihadists, along with Lamine Ould M. Salam, and the film is out in theaters now. That does it for me today. Stay tuned next week when I feature my interview with Canadian indie film icon John Capellos, best known as Carl the Janitor from The Breakfast Club. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.